This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. A recent study in the journal Archives of Neurology describes a looming healthcare crisis in this country, Alzheimer's. Today, this dreaded disease affects more than 4 million Americans. Barring a cure or a vaccine, that number is expected to grow to well over 7 million by 2030. And, of course, the number of lives affected is much greater. Most people with Alzheimer's are cared for at home by family and friends. Many of them describe that as a devastating experience. People with Alzheimer's can have trouble with the basic tasks of life. They can be combative. They can have severe mood swings. Sometimes they simply forget where they are and who they are. As more people develop Alzheimer's, there is, of course, more and more discussion about how to care for them. And fortunately, we are learning something about how that experience can be better, or at least less frustrating, both for the caregivers and for the person who has the disease. Later in this program, your letters, and we'll remember the country's first African-American mayor, Walter Washington. But first, Alzheimer's. If this is something you've had to deal with in your life, please call and tell us your story. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK, and our email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us is Joanne Koenig-Kost. She's the author of a new book, Learning to Speak Alzheimer's. She's with us here in Studio 3A. Thanks so much for coming in today.
Thank you, Neil.
Your experience with Alzheimer's starts with a personal story.
Yes, it does. It started back in the early 1970s when my husband exhibited some rather bizarre behaviors. And a routine examination by a physician said that he most likely, since he was in his early 40s, was suffering from some sort of a depression. And I accepted that. I discovered at the same time that I was pregnant with a fourth child and thought that that might be adding to the depression. But there were many other things that happened that were changing his personality and changing the way that he was looking upon life. Once a very positive person, he became rather negative. And I think the first time that I realized something was happening was when I had pulled into a favorite cafe in front of a parking meter that had lots of money in it, and I exclaimed how wonderful it was that the meter still had money in it. Mm-hmm. And he looked at me rather sadly and said, "I think my meter might just be running out." Mm-hmm. And I had no idea that that subtle metaphor was a symbol of what was to come in the years that followed.
We associate Alzheimer's with loss of memory. Sounds like that was hardly the only symptom.
Now, it is hardly the only symptom, and true of Alzheimer's disease. Memory loss is a symptom. There are many, many others. He was forgetting the things that had happened the day before, the evening before. But he, like Alzheimer's people, had a very good hold on what the past was. He, in fact, had multi-infarct dementia, which is a cousin to Alzheimer's disease. It's one of those related disorders. And he, in 1973, had a massive stroke, which changed our lives irrevocably.
Now, when your husband became sick, what kinds of resources were available to you to help you know what to do?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked that, Neil, because there were none. So what an easy question to answer. There was absolutely nothing. There were no signposts, no guidelines, no advocacy, no National Alzheimer's Association. That wasn't formed for another decade.
My memory goes back that far, and it's pretty good, at least 30 years ago. The name Alzheimer's was not even current then.
No. Alzheimer's disease was first used back in the early 1900s when Dr. Alzheimer's put his name to it. But really nothing much was done about it until the late 1960s in Europe. It was re-looked at. And then nothing until 1980, when the Alzheimer's Association was born, did the nation really put a term to it. We had used so many wrong terms describing Alzheimer's disease prior to the Alzheimer's Association. Mm-hmm. Senile dementia, I think, is the most common, and we now know that there's a myth to senility. We use terms like organic brain syndrome and chronic brain syndrome and hardening of the arteries. And many of those, like chronic brain syndrome, means your brain's alive, and that sounds rather comforting to me, actually, in retrospect.
Well, looking back, what was the hardest part for you? Was not knowing really what he had the hardest part?
The most difficult part when I look back is being alone, having no one to talk to about it. And the people I did find to talk about it were saying, well, there isn't anything that can be done. It is a fatal illness we are dealing with, mm-hmm. with no name to it. All I knew was that life for us was changing and that I had a choice to make, and the choice was whether to give up and give in or to fight and fight like heck.
As you mentioned, you had children, some of whom were still pretty young, throughout this experience.
Oh, yes.
There must come an awful moment when you no longer trust their father around them.
There was a time when that did happen. And it happened only for fleeting moments, though, until I realized that there were ways that we could change his angry behavior. Aggressive behavior and angry behavior is a result of frustration with Alzheimer's people. We've always looked upon these things, Neil, as being offensive behaviors, but they're not. They're defensive, and they're defensive in nature. Alzheimer's people defend themselves against a world they simply don't understand.
So there's a logic to it.
There's a logic to it, and there's a trigger. There's a trigger to behavior. We need to find out what the triggers are. If we know what the trigger is, we can then find out the way to change the behavior itself. I believe we can change behavior of Alzheimer's people. I think we have to change us. Hmm. That's what we have to change.
Well, out of this experience, beginning with your husband, you've developed an approach, and we're going to talk about the specifics in a minute, but in general, it's based on seeing the world from the perspective of the Alzheimer's patient. What do you mean, seeing it through their eyes?
I think it's getting into the world of the Alzheimer person. We sometimes waste so much time looking at what he used to be that we neglect the moment that we have before us. That can be a glorious and wonderful moment. Our people living with Alzheimer's are not going to be the person they once were. They are a new person. We need to find ways that we can celebrate who they are, get into the world that they are in now, wherever that world may be. And if it's back with their mother, who might have passed away 40 years ago, then we too need to be back there. I've had wonderful conversations about Franklin Delano Roosevelt last week.
Really? I mean, you don't try to say, wait a minute, Mr. Roosevelt is no longer president, and in fact, there's been several presidents since then.
Absolutely not. All that does is antagonize the person. It makes them more aware of what their losses are. It sets us up to have confrontation, and confrontation is what leads to the distress of the caregiver and the distress of the patient.
So just simply say yes, we're looking forward to the fireside chat tonight.
You got it. You got it. That's right. Let's turn on our radios.
Another of your tenets is know that communication remains possible as long as they're still talking.
I think that's the most important one. Communication, in terms of words, is going to be lost. That is a given. But the ability to communicate with a person who has Alzheimer's disease doesn't leave until the person is gone to a world beyond ours. There are other ways to communicate, and we must learn those ways because it's totally possible.
We want to hear from you this hour, especially those of you who are living with Alzheimer's disease. Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and our email address is totn@npr.org. And now let's start with Rebecca, who's with us on the line from Portland, Oregon.
Hi. My grandmother came, she passed away about 5-6 years ago, but right before she passed away, I had twin girls, and my parents drove with her 3.5 hours from St. Louis, Missouri to Champaign, Illinois, where I was living at the time, to see my babies. And she was so agitated the whole time because she was convinced that she was going to see some other twins who were her kinfolk, and I kept trying to explain how these were the twins, and this was her daughter, and I was her granddaughter, and these were her great-granddaughters, and she was so agitated. She was supposed to be somewhere else. She went out and sat in the car, and they finally had to turn around and leave. And I'm just wondering, you know, was there a better way to handle that? We could not convince her to enjoy this or to stay with us.
What a wonderful example of what we were just talking about, Rebecca. When, in fact, when we talk about getting into somebody else's world, it is wherever she was with whatever twins she was with. You see, the problem is that we're reasoning with somebody who has lost the ability to reason, and you would not have reasoned with your twins. Reasoning with grandmother has the same effect.
Mm-hmm.
And so how might she have been able to deal with that?
by suggesting that these were, in fact, the same twins, or not trying to fight exactly with Grandmom, or not trying to describe what the situation was, but to be interested in what twins Grandmom was, in fact, talking about.
Tried to do, but, you know, she was sitting in the car, so they finally decided they just had to leave.
Which was the most appropriate thing you could have possibly done.
Rebecca, okay. That kind of situation, it's really hard not to take it, you know, as some form of rejection.
Well, I felt sad for her more than me. I knew that, you know, it wasn't against me or anything. I just felt bad that she couldn't enjoy it. It was like a chance to see your great-grandkids, and she could not enjoy it.
Right. I think it's important to realize, though, that the opportunity to enjoy Grandma might have still been there. Sometimes taking people on rides and driving the long distance might have set her up for failure to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
I have a nice picture, and I cherish that.
Oh, do, and make sure your children get to cherish Grandmom, too.
I will. Thank you.
Thanks, Rebecca.
Bye-bye.
Email question we have from Chris Zelenka in Chandler, Arizona. What is the difference between Alzheimer's and senility?
Well, senility is really a term that we're trying not to use anymore. And when we think of senility, we're more apt to think of the word dementia, because they usually go together. And dementia and senility are symptoms of something else. If somebody is showing signs of not being able to function the way they once did, it is reason enough to seek the knowledge of a physician or neurologist. Somebody else.
Well, a lot of people with friends or relatives who have Alzheimer's, in many cases, in the early stages, just getting a diagnosis is a challenge. Any advice for people with friends or loved ones in that early stage?
When the person is reluctant to get the diagnosis, which frequently happens because I think probably they realize their worst fears might in fact be justified, sometimes we suggest that you go and make an appointment for the doctor with yourself. You are the patient. You are the one going, and you want Mom to come along with you. Let the doctor know in advance that really you want Mom to be looked at. Again, it's very important that when somebody is losing the ability to make decisions for themselves, that we're going to have to be unpopular. We maybe are going to have to be the scapegoat. Maybe Mom is not going to like us as much as she once did. She's always going to love us. Mm. But that's the choice. It's between that and not acting and not getting a diagnosis. I think it's important, Neil, that we certainly share with the listeners that there are many things that mimic Alzheimer's that are, in fact, curable. They're treatable. They're reversible. I had a support group member whose mom was exhibiting signs of Alzheimer's, and the family doctor had said that that's surely what it was. After all, she was 78 years old and forgetful, and what did we expect? And in the group, the girl had said that, in fact, she expected her mother to perform much better at that age. We insisted, pushed her to get her mom to have a good evaluation done. And a CAT scan, routine CAT scan during the evaluation, showed a brain tumor. The brain tumor was excised. Her mom went back to better than the way she was functioning before the diagnosis. Had nothing to do with Alzheimer's. Imperative that people get an appropriate diagnosis.
And not panic every time you forget where the car keys were.
That's right, don't we all? What car keys, Neil?
And, you know, it seems to advance through age. You know, we can remember the phone number that we had when we were, you know, 8 years old.
That's
and
right.
Growing up in New Jersey or wherever it happened to be. But maybe the one you've got now may slip your mind just for a moment. And there's all that moment of panic that, you know, you suddenly see this horrible future in front of you, and Alzheimer's is a terrible disease. But the fact of the matter is that without that diagnosis and the tests that you're talking about, you don't know anything.
That's right. That's right. And there are things that could be treatable. What if? We don't want to ever take that chance.
We're discussing Alzheimer's disease and strategies for caregivers. If you're a person caring for somebody with Alzheimer's, we'd like to hear how you're coping. We'll have more of your calls after we come back from a break. 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Or you can send us email. The address, totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Our guest here in Studio 3A is Joanne Koenig-Kost. She's the author of Learning to Speak Alzheimer's, and we're taking your calls about the challenges you may be facing in dealing with this disease and what you may have learned. Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is TOTN at NPR.org. And our next caller is Tom, who's with us in Raleigh, North Carolina.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air, Tom.
Thanks. I'm a member of the baby boomer generation who was a caregiver for my mother with Alzheimer's and for my mother-in-law with Alzheimer's. Luckily, they did not have this both at the same time. But I think the biggest problem facing the caregivers is the baby boomer generation who look at their parents that could be developing disease, and they also feel that they could be going down that road also.
I think that's very true.
And the scary thing, I'm involved with a lot of support groups.
Good.
A lot of Alzheimer's organizations, and the biggest fear that they have is that the massive amount of potential Alzheimer's inflicted people in the future is going to be staggering to the economy and to families.
You're absolutely right on target, Tom. I agree with you wholeheartedly. I think the two things that we worry the most about is the incredible numbers we're going to face in the future and who the heck is going to be paying for it. And as you know, go ahead, Tom.
I feel like in all the support groups I've been involved with is the acceptance of the disease. I find so many people do not want to accept the disease because they feel like they could be there in a number of years also. It's going to take a lot of education, a lot of support groups, a lot of awareness, federal, state levels, community, local levels, and all that to make people aware of what's coming.
And
it is coming.
And to also make them aware of the fact that because mom or grandmom had Alzheimer's does not mean that we are going to have it. And I think that's very important. And you're absolutely right. That is education. We're doing a lot more public service announcements and programs like today, which certainly help.
But I assume both Tom and Joanne, one of the first questions you must get from the kids is this genetic?
Oh, absolutely. And there certainly is a genetic component, but the amount of people who have familial Alzheimer's, that kind of Alzheimer's that runs in families, is not a statistic that's going to scare us. It's probably somewhere around 10% and not the 90% that we so fear.
Well, one of the things to consider, too, remember, there's been several shows on NPR saying that the diseases of 50 years ago were the flu that killed people, and now people are living into their 80s and 90s. And as you progress in age, the potential for having some type of dementia increases with that age. Now, of course, there may be drug discoveries and all of that.
Well, of course.
What we're seeing, I think, is an effect of people being able to live longer.
Right, and I think that's exactly right. And our emphasis has been on longevity and not necessarily on living well. But I think it's very important that we learn once Alzheimer's has been diagnosed that we can still live well.
Have you ever thought about writing a book?
She's got a book right here. It's called Learning to Speak Alzheimer's.
Good.
Thanks, Tom.
Good luck.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Let's go now to Ann, and Ann's with us from Sacramento, California.
Hi, Ann.
Hi, Jean. I just want to thank you so much. I'm intrigued by the title of your book. I have been the primary caregiver for 4 years now for my father-in-law, who is ironically a retired professor of psychiatry. And I wanted to make a point. I think it is very important to try to be where the patient is, the family member is, and go forward for the quality of their life. And I would like to make another observation and see if it's something you found. And that is that I think women have the ability to make the sort of symbolic leaps that these patients often do as word retrieval becomes more problematic, or they default to almost telling the same sort of stories. I find that I'm able to understand what he says far better than my husband and to get where he is coming from and perhaps where he's going. Is that something that you discovered?
I think that might be the personal relationship. I don't think it is gender-oriented. I think I've seen some incredibly wonderful male caregivers who speak Alzheimer's.
It is, and I was very curious. I will wait for later in the show, but if you have some basic tenets about what it's like to speak Alzheimer's, obviously you need to listen a lot more as opposed to direct. But what have you found that is particularly useful in learning to speak so that
yes.
I can teach my kids
yes, yes.
and others to perhaps understand and go with it a little better?
I think listening to the emotion behind
right.
the failing words. That's what is more important than anything. What is the basic emotion the patient is expressing?
Frustration often.
Yes, and not listening to the words. And when somebody is frustrated, we need to be able to be comfortable saying to them, this must be awful for you,
right.
instead of saying the things that historically we've always said,
we
which is...
correct them.
That's right. We want to correct them, or we want to say, gosh, this will pass, or I'm forgetful too, or this is just a normal part of aging. This is not a normal part of aging.
Oh, no, no, it absolutely is not. And I really look forward to getting your book and reading it, because I have found that there are ways of giving so much pleasure, but it cannot necessarily meet your expectations.
That's exactly right. Yes. But it's a different kind of pleasure. It's a new kind of pleasure.
It's the field trips. I've kind of joked that we take field trips. So I feel like I'm the cruise director, trying to
yes.
figure out what activities will work on any given day. And for weeks now, depending on the weather, we're looking forward to go see the leaves.
And that's a spiritual enrichment as well as it is the companionship of somebody that I'm sure your parent loves.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Bless you for your work. I look forward to reading your book.
Thank you.
Take care.
Thanks, Ann. Joanne, I don't mean to be disrespectful in any way, but this doesn't sound like rocket science. I mean, if the previous approach didn't work, why aren't more people using this kind of approach?
Well, I think it's because we've never really stopped to think that the patient, the person with Alzheimer's, has anything less left. Neil, we've been so busy dealing with the losses of Alzheimer's that we haven't stopped to look and say what's left in the patient, what is still there, what emotions remain, what skills remain, and capitalize on them, realizing that the person with Alzheimer's is not gone. They're still here. They might be a different person, but they still have skills and wondrous things that they can still do with us, for us, and we can be care partners. We can partnership with our care with the Alzheimer person and not be in this by ourselves.
Let's go with Karina, who's with us from McMinnville, Oregon.
Yes, hello.
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 You're on the air, Karina.
Hi. I am a provider in McMinnville, Oregon, and
excuse me, Karina, does that mean you run some sort of a facility or daycare
yes,
center?
Yes. I run an Alzheimer's care facility in McMinnville.
Great.
And what we find, what my challenge is in this industry is education, both for providers but also to the community as a whole, because nobody wants to face this problem until they have to. First of all, until they're afflicted with the disease process, the education just isn't out there.
Well, I hear what you're saying, but I think that with the association and the one that's local to you, too, have done an incredible job at providing education and educational tools and materials. I think sometimes we need to know where it is that we can access them. I'm in complete accord with you, too, that I think education is the bottom line for all of this, whether it be for the provider, for the physician, the hospital, the daycare center, the at-home caregiver. They must be educated and realize that there are things we can do. And hurrah for you being out there doing Alzheimer's work. In is it long-term care?
It's in Oregon, it's called residential care.
Uh-huh.
But for me, yes, it is long-term care. We have residents, our facility is 5 years old, and we have residents that are in all stages of the disease process. And I think providers need to accept the onus of learning and educating themselves about the disease process. Oregon is very, in my opinion anyway, responsive to the disease process and
yes.
in general. We have an Alzheimer's care licensure from the state, so we have to go above and beyond what other facilities have to do.
You certainly do.
Staff.
And my fondest hope is that the day will come when 50 states have to have some sort of licensure to provide care. The dilemma we have right now is that facilities are allowed to have locked doors or secured residences and call them special care, and they are not. Mm-hmm. There has to be a philosophy of care and programming and tons of education to go along with it.
Absolutely, and I think really education is definitely the key.
Yes, it is.
And I think I want to just validate your point about making sure that people understand that there is still a person in there, and it may be not be the person that they knew their whole life, but it's still somebody that they can have a relationship with.
That's right. And I think sometimes that staff in special care units have one-upmanship on the family in that they don't have the history with the patient, and they can develop these wonderful new relationships and find something in the person that family, in fact, wasn't able to see. So staff can teach families, too.
Yes, absolutely, and ours does do that. And I have to say, on a kind of a sad note, just this morning in the Statesman Journal, which is the Salem, Oregon newspaper, there is an article about our local chapter of the Alzheimer's Association that's closing because of funding.
And, oh, how sad.
I was very disappointed with that because we get a lot of support from them. Now we have to go up to Portland instead of Salem. It's not a big deal. But I don't want to see these chapters closing. This is what I choose to do for a living, and I don't want to see the funding go away.
Well, I'm awfully glad you're there. Keep advocating, and remember our public policy.
Karina, that's another victim of the state budget crisis?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
That's sad.
Another program. I think we may have done it two or three times already, in fact. Karina, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
So long. Joanne, what kind of work are you doing to try to get more facilities and more people to adopt your approach?
Well, just getting the word out there and showing the facilities that have practiced habilitation and how very successful they feel. And isn't that really what it's all about, that we can go in and visit a facility where we have happy patients, happy family, staff that does not want to quit?
Here's an email question we got from Jim Sazevich. Sazevich, I've pronounced that correctly, I hope. I need to interview a person suffering from Alzheimer's for a family history publication. She's unable to communicate verbally. How do you suggest I try to communicate my questions and make suggestions for a way for her to answer me? She has good days and bad days as far as cognitive ability goes.
I would suggest, first of all, that you try to visit her in the morning and as soon after she's out of bed and has done her activity of daily living, get to see her. I suggest also that you use pictures, that you use photographs, family photos, and try to concentrate on the photographs from many, many years ago. Depending on how old your person is, I would go back 30 or 40 years and try to get some photographs or pictures of the times that are going to evoke memories in her. That's what's most important, is that you get, again, into her world. And her world, remember, is going to be one when she was much younger.
And be patient, I suppose.
Very patient. And if she doesn't answer a very simple question, and remember simplicity is the key here, repeat the question. Repeat it exactly the same way that you said it before and give her time to process the information. And above all else, remember, she is reading your body language. So be very careful that you don't show frustration or the fact that you're getting tired or that you've spent enough time with her, because she's going to pick up on that immediately and probably clam up.
So just because they're having difficulty maybe with their memory doesn't mean they're any less sharp.
That's right. That's right, exactly. It's accessing the memory is the problem. You see, the memory, we talk about memory loss. I'm not convinced the memory is actually lost. I think the problem is that we can't access it. But if we have the proper cues, and we're given the proper cues, we usually can access the memory.
Joanne Koenig-Kost is the author of Learning to Speak Alzheimer's. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And now let's go to Lisa. And Lisa is in Alameda, California.
Hi, Lisa.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
Are you there?
Yes, we're here, Lisa. Go ahead.
Okay, good. I'm 44. My mother has had Alzheimer's for probably noticeable for 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
And my question is, how do you prevent or how do you keep seniors safe from telemarketing fraud? My mother was victimized terribly to the tune of over $50,000.
Oh, how sad. How sad. That's probably another whole other show, too, Neil, I'm sure. In fact, there's probably very little you can do unless you are listening, living with her. A private line might be a way to go. Unlisted telephone number probably is also another option. By all means, get in touch with your local, first of all, your Alzheimer's Association, the police department in your area, and the Council on Aging. All of them can give you viable tips for dealing with pranksters and the elderly. A very, very sad commentary, but a very true one, too.
It is. It's past tense now because she's in a nursing home.
Yes.
That, and doesn't have access to a telephone or to her funds.
Thank heavens. But hopefully this will help other people. And I'm so glad that you mentioned it because it's a caveat. It certainly is something that caregivers should be aware of, that these things can happen.
Absolutely. And I just want to say one other thing, that I think the people who are the caregivers in facilities are absolute angels, because I visit my mother regularly, but to do it, you know, 40 hours plus a week is a very incredible task.
And most of them are angels.
Above and beyond. Yeah.
Indeed.
Thanks very much, Lisa, and good luck.
Thank you. Okay.
Let's go to Muffet. Muffet's in Montrose, Colorado.
Hi.
Hi, Muffet.
I have a comment for other caregivers. I've been caring for my mom for 4 years.
Yes.
You can't do it by yourself.
No, you can't.
I got help, a respite care, a couple hours a week right now for me, for my sanity, and to get away for a while.
Good for you. I think it's, you know, we need to realize when we use the word respite, that respite is for the caregiver. It's not for the patient. And I think that if we don't learn to take respite and take care of ourselves, we are never going to be good caregivers. We have to take care of us.
Muffet, what do you do when you get a couple of hours off?
Run.
Good. Away?
I'll just go shopping, go
Great.
For a walk, take my dogs out.
Yeah. I try to teach people to be selfish, and I think that if we're selfish enough, we learn that we take times for ourselves regardless of what else is going on and what's happening, and we have to do it on a very scheduled basis. I think an hour every 3 or 4 days and a half a day every 2 weeks is mandatory. And I think also being able to use that horrendous four-letter word, H-E-L-P, we're so reluctant to say we need help. We're so afraid, I think, that we're going to show to the public that maybe we can't do it ourselves. Nobody can do it themselves, and that underscores what you said.
It's just too hard. It's just too demanding.
That's right.
Where did you find help, Muffet?
A home health organization in town, and also my neighbor.
Great.
Gives me breaks.
Great, great. And there are home health agencies in every town throughout the United States. They have different names. They're called different things, but they are there. We also have clergy and family resources, and we have pets.
Sorry.
That sounds like somebody else needs to go out, Muffet.
Yeah, those are my sanity.
Good for you.
Got to have my dogs. Can I make two other comments?
If you keep it short.
Okay, one is always remember it's not their fault.
Yeah.
That's right, and remember that it's when behavior isn't what we want it to be, it's not the person, it's the disease doing that.
And my mom has had a couple of unexplained moments of brilliance where her memory did come back.
That's right.
That emphasized what you said, that it is going in, it's just not being accessed.
Okay, thanks.
Muffet, thanks very much, and hang in there, okay?
Thanks.
We're discussing strategies to cope with Alzheimer's disease. Our guest is Joanne Koenig-Castle. She's the author of a new book, Cost is her last name. She's the author of a new book titled Learning to Speak Alzheimer's. More of your calls after we come back after a short break. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington, and here are a few of the stories NPR News is working on this afternoon. At least 34 people are dead, 224 wounded after four separate explosions in Baghdad. Suicide bombers hit the headquarters of the International Red Crescent Society and three police stations. Fires, meanwhile, continue to rage in Southern California. National Guard troops are being brought into areas where wildfires are blamed for at least 13 deaths. They've destroyed more than 800 homes. 30,000 other homes are endangered. Details on those stories coming up later today on All Things Considered. Tomorrow on Talk of the Nation, well, just about everything gets marketed in America, including religion. Join us for a look at how churches compete and how you choose where to express your faith. Right now, we're wrapping up our discussion about Alzheimer's disease, and we have time for a few more calls with Joanne Koenig-Kost. She's the author of Learning to Speak Alzheimer's, and our next caller is Pat, who's with us from Cleveland, Ohio.
Oh, hi. I take care of my brother, who's 55 and has advanced, Alzheimer's.
Bless you, Pat.
Yeah, I know. And first, one of my fears is he's taken to taking off all of his clothes.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
And my fear, this might sound weird, but my fear is, you know, he's in the end stage and he is going to die sometime. But if he dies with no clothes on and they come in, are they going to say, why don't you dress him? You know?
Yeah, well, something you might try is getting a jumpsuit and putting it on him backwards.
You know, I've thought of that, but then he gets angry if he can't do what he wants to do.
Yeah, but chances are he's going to concentrate a little bit harder. If he's in the end stage of the disease, I would suggest to you that you do try that. And I also suggest that you try what we call a busy apron. Get a hold of an apron, a carpenter's apron, something like that. Buttons okay. in the back, snaps in the back, ties in the back. And what you do is you sew interesting things on the front of it. Your Alzheimer's Association probably will have a suggestion on where you might buy one that's already done. National Alzheimer's Association does.
Oh, they're wonderful, yeah.
Yes, mm-hmm. indeed. But you can sew things on, buttons and things that are interesting to him. If he's interested in something, he's not going to be interested in taking his clothes off. Do
okay.
try it.
Okay.
Okay, thanks for calling.
Okay, thanks.
Pat, good luck.
Oh, thanks a lot.
Okay.
Okay.
I wonder, Joanne, at the same time you're telling yourself, look, it's not their fault, caregivers must feel terribly guilty sometimes.
Oh, yes, they do feel guilty. And you could, I could hear the guilt in this young lady's voice. And, you know, what a terrible thing for her to be going through. And I think also something else that we don't talk about is the younger people who are involved with Alzheimer's disease. I come across a lot of grandchildren and children of Alzheimer's people who are very embarrassed with the way their grandparent or parent are acting. Embarrassment is a very active emotion in the caregivers.
Sure, you can't have your friends over.
That's sure. right. We yeah. certainly can't. Well, I went through that with my own children, not wanting to bring anyone home because, you know, Dad did behave a little bit bizarre and other people's fathers didn't.
Mm-hmm. Let's go with Nancy, who's in Menlo Park, California.
Yes, I was the director of an adult day program for 14 years.
And wonderful.
Many families, most families in most cities, I think across the nation, are not aware of adult day care. It is a very important respite for family members. And it's also for people with Alzheimer's, it gives them a purpose in their lives.
It most assuredly does, and I recommend it and I describe it in the book too, because I thoroughly believe that it is a great stepping stone. It's that place between home care and somebody who's not ready for assisted living or for long-term care. And I think it buys respite for the family member too.
Right.
Hurrah for you for doing this.
Well, my father had Alzheimer's. And,
yes.
My mother had Parkinson's that went into dementia.
Right.
In fact, my father had been my mother's caregiver. And as a family member, the incredible heartache you feel. And if you have, you know, once you get involved, the important thing is to call either your Alzheimer's Association or call the, if you cannot find one of those in your area, the senior center, and find out where there is adult day care.
You're absolutely right. And we also have to find more creative ways for paying for it so that everybody across the nation can access adult day health. It's a wonderful source for the Alzheimer families.
And thanks very much for the phone call, by the way. Joanne Koenig-Kost, it's been great to have you here.
Thanks so much, Neil.
We could be here all day, but...
I wish we could.
Maybe we'll have you back when it comes out in paper.
Thank you.
Joanne Koenig-Kost is the author of a new book called Learning to Speak Alzheimer's, A Groundbreaking Approach for Everyone Dealing with the Disease.